All right, so if you look here at the doctrine of God, we're going to look at the existence of God. The greatest and most profound idea the human mind can ever conceivably entertain concerns the possibility of the existence of a personal God. The sheer importance of man's response to this idea cannot be exaggerated, for it will not only govern his life down here, but will also determine his ultimate destiny. Unless one satisfactorily answers the who question, he cannot possibly solve the how, why, when, and where problems of his own existence. So you have to figure out who first before you can start answering the rest of those questions. You know who God is. And so that's what this whole course is going to be about. And I'm hoping it's going to really be a blessing to you guys. Letter A. Now there's some philosophical arguments for the existence of God. The first one is the universal belief argument. So what I'll do is I'll kind of give you the definition about that. That's why I left it blank there on the page there. So the universal belief argument is that all mankind has some idea of a supreme being. All mankind has some idea of a supreme being. That's the universal belief argument.
All mankind has
some idea of a supreme being. You look at most religions, even tribal religions, they believe that there is a God up above, that there is a supreme being in control of their life. I mean, even way out in the jungles of Africa, the jungles of South America, there are people that they have a belief in a God. A supreme being, and they just don't know who he is. They have no idea. That's why it's so important that we need to send someone there to preach the gospel. Now, this argument has often been challenged, but has never been refuted or proven wrong. While the concepts of God found among many cultures and civilizations differ greatly on the number or the name and nature of the supreme being, nevertheless, the idea remains. For example, in Hinduism, there's three main gods, but there's 200 some plus minor gods. But there's always the three main gods, and so different cultures have a different mindset of who God is, but they believe in a God. That's the thing. A classic example of this is the amazing story of Helen Keller, who lived from 1880 to 1968. From the age of 2, Miss Keller was blind, she was deaf, and without the sense of smell. So imagine those disadvantages that you'd have. Blind, can't hear, can't smell. From 2 years old. After months of agonizing and fruitless attempts on the part of her teacher to communicate with this young girl, a miracle occurred. One day, Helen suddenly understood the concept and meaning of running water. From this humble foundation, Miss Keller built a lofty tower of thought, including the ability to use her voice in speaking. She became an educated and articulate human being. Sometime after, she had progressed to the point that she could engage in conversation. Now again, she can't hear, she can't see, and she can't smell. When she was actually able to have a conversation, she was told of God and his love in sending Christ to die on the cross. This is what she said. She said to have responded with joy. She said, "I always knew that he was there, but I didn't know his name. I always knew that he was there, but I didn't know his name." Even she, blind, can't hear, but she knew that there was a God there, but she just didn't know who he was. And there's many people all over this world that fall in that same category. They believe that there's a God, but they have no idea who, or even how to get to him, or how to talk to him. So that's part of the universal belief. Second is the cosmological argument. To this one is that life itself is overwhelming proof of the existence of a creator God. And that
everything in existence
must have adequate cause. So something has to cause everything that's in existence. Basically, another way of saying it. Everything in existence must have an adequate cause. It didn't just appear. So if something exists... Oh, sorry. Let me go back up here. So there's no other way to explain the intricate design of an incredibly complex and ordered universe other than through the infinite intelligence and power of an infinite designer. Now, what I mean by having everything in existence must have an adequate cause, if something exists, it must either be eternal or else it must come from nothing. The universe shows much evidence of change that argues against it being eternal. So our universe isn't eternal. One day, it's going to be remade. It's going to end. And God's going to create a new universe. So the universe had to originate from nothing. So the universe had to originate from nothing, and so must have been created. It's not eternal, so it has to be created. The creation had to be the work of a creator surpassing the limits of the universe. A man by the name of Robert Calvert, he writes this. He says, one of the great names of British science, mathematics, and philosophy is Sir Isaac Newton. From 1642 to 1727 is when he lived. Sir Isaac had a miniature model of the solar system made. A large golden ball representing the sun was at its center, and around it revolved small spheres representing the planets Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and others. They were each kept in an orbit relatively the same as in the real solar system. By means of rods, cogwheels, and belts, they all moved around the center gold ball in exact precision. Excuse me. A friend called on the noted man, so he stopped by, and one day, while he was studying the model. The friend was not a believer in the biblical doctrine of divine creation. And so according to reports, their conversation went as follows. This is what his friend said. My, Newton, what an exquisite thing. Who made it for you? Newton said, nobody. The friend said, nobody. And Newton replied, that's right, I said nobody. All these balls and cogs and belts and gears just happened to come together. And wonder of wonders, by chance they began revolving in their set orbits and in perfect timing. Of course, the visitor understood the unexpressed argument. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So the visitor was saying, wow, that's a great model. Who did it? You know? So as an illustration, he said, oh, nobody. It just all suddenly just appeared that way. We have, when we look at the universe, you can't just, it doesn't just happen. It was designed. And that's what the cosmological argument is all about, that it's everything in the universe exists because of God. Now, the ontological argument. This is the concept that a God far beyond the intellect of man. I'll break it up in chunks for you guys.
This is the concept.
The ontological argument. So it's the concept that a God.
Far beyond.
The intellect of man can exist. In the human mind.
Human mind.
Only through. Yep. The power. of that God. That's a long definition.
Only through the power of that God.
Yes. Okay, so the ontological argument is the concept that a God far beyond the intellect of man can exist in the human mind only through the power of that God. Now, the fact of an intuitive belief in some kind of God by all or most men is a proof of God's existence, since it is something innate in our being, yet beyond our senses, and so must be placed within us by a creator. That desire to worship has got to be something that God has put in us. It's just not something that just develops. It's something that God put into us. The very fact that men of higher learning are always trying to come up with some alternative to a creator God through exaltation of humanistic concepts shows that many men of intellect are uncomfortable in their own inherent religious notions to do all in their power to deny them. So in other words, that just sums up that men of higher learning, they're always trying to find an alternative to God because they don't like what they see.
What are you supposed to be writing this down?
Oh, these are just notes if you want to put in the side of your paper there or whatever. I'm sorry. If you want me to repeat something, just say, could you repeat that, please? So, yeah, if you guys have a question or anything, just wave your hand at me and get my attention. I can repeat something if you want me to repeat it. So that's not a problem.
Is there any opportunity to see your notes, those extra notes?
Or? That I have to ask Pastor about.
I mean, all the stuff you just said to us, not...
Right. So religion is such an inherent part of the inner self that such men do nothing more than invent alternative secular religion in the form of humanism and evolution, which are purely matters of blind faith that defy reason. So inside, God has put that desire inside us. And rather than use it, what God has put into us to bring us to God, they instead say, no, this is what God is. And they try to elevate something else in the place of God. And they put their belief in that, like evolution, like humanism, things like that. So they try to, in a sense, they're trying to deny God what they know is in their inner hearts, screaming out, saying, trust me, you know, believe in me. Instead, they're saying, they're putting their focus on something to somehow deviate from that desire that God has put in every single person. And so that's what the ontological argument's all about.
Just to finish that one sentence, religion is such an inherent part.
Of the inner self.
Of the inner self.
Yeah. That such men do nothing more than invent alternative secular religion in the form of humanism and evolution. A man by the name of C.C. Ryrie writes this. He says, man has an idea of a most perfect being. This idea includes the idea of existence. Since a being otherwise perfect, who did not exist, would not be as perfect as a perfect being who did exist. Therefore, since the idea of existence is contained in the idea of the most perfect being, the most perfect being must exist. Sounds like, you know, something out of, you know, Cat in the Hat or something like that, you know. Don't worry, it made my head hurt as well. Basically that since man thinks that there has got to be a perfect being up there in control of everything, proves that there is a God that's has created everything. You know, and that desire to say there must be proves that there is. That's just another way of simplifying what he was saying there. So that's the ontological argument. Number next, the anthropological argument. The anthropological argument. Say that 5 times fast. All right, this is the conscience. So this is your next fill in there. The conscience and moral nature of man demands a self-conscious and moral maker. Okay, so this built-in barometer supplies no information, and the information in which it passes judgment may be incorrect. But nevertheless, the conscience tells us that we ought to do what is right regarding the information that we have. I mean, we've all had that conscience when we had, you know, we went to maybe steal something, or we went to do something that inside us was saying, don't do it, it's wrong. You know, that God has given us that. And for us to have that demands that there's got to be a God that also is moral, that also has that right and wrong, that he's given within us to help us not make a mess of things. But we oftentimes sear our conscience, as the Bible says, through sin, and then we destroy it. But God has given everybody a conscience to help them make choices, the right choices. All right, next one. Teleological argument. All right, the teleological argument is the observation. So this is the next one, Emrio.
The observation that the universe is based on order and intelligent design.
Indicative of an intelligent cause.
An intelligent cause and purpose.
Right, these are some long definitions. So I'll go over it one more time. The observation that the universe is based on order and intelligent design, indicative of an intelligent cause and purpose. So when you look at it, it says design cannot originate within the thing designed, and thus it is indicative of an intelligent designer from outside the design system. So something couldn't have designed it from within. Had to design it from outside. So that's what it's saying, is that, you know, you look at the order and the intelligent design of our world, our planet, our solar system, everything. You look at that, and you have to realize that, look, had it been created from an outside source, not from within. And so that's what that argument is about. Okay. So other arguments, first one is the moral argument. Now, I don't think I got any of these on here, so these are extra. So the moral argument, this is the sense of right and wrong is in all of mankind, along with a sense of responsibility for doing right and self-condemnation for doing wrong. These feelings are not self-imposed and thus can only originate with God. Man's sense of duty is often in conflict with his feelings and often overcomes them. Since the voice of conscience brings a sense of guilt when violated, it is clearly external to man's self-interest and must have an external origin, meaning something had to have given us a conscience. It wasn't something that we just develop inside of us. This is something that God has given to us. But most people have a sense of right and wrong in them. Sometimes their sense of right and wrong is different because of culture, because of how they're raised in the home, what they grow up in as, but most people have a sense of right and wrong. When sin is lifted up and raised up, that difference of what is being wrong is gone. They think it's okay. They think it's fine to do this. You know, we've always done it. This is what my culture says is right, even though the Bible says it's wrong. And so that's when the Bible supersedes culture, is when things are wrong, we need to change and say, no, we need to do what the Bible says. But most people, they have a right and wrong. There's some countries where it's not wrong to rape women. There's not wrong to murder. It's not wrong to steal. It's accepted in their culture. Does it make it right or wrong? Or does it make it right that they can do it? No. But they're, even in that sense, they know that there's some things that are wrong that they shouldn't be doing. But God shows us through His Word and through that conscience, you know what? I shouldn't be doing this. And so it's just there's different things for right and wrong. All right. Scriptural arguments for the existence of God. That's the next one. So the next blank there is none. So your next blank, embryo, is none. Letter B. None.
Okay.
So here's the explanation for that. You're probably wondering, why is there no explanation for God, within Scripture? Why is that? Well, first of all, the Bible simply assumes the existence of God, that He already exists. It doesn't have to go to prove that God exists. The Bible confirms that He exists. So that's the first one, is that there's several arguments that I have here for you. First one is that simply that the Bible simply assumes the existence of God. Psalm 14:1 says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good." Secondly, the prophets who penned the words of our Old Testament seem never to have thought it necessary to prove the existence of God. Obviously, because they experienced God as He spoke to them and through them. So, I mean, if just imagine you're an Old Testament prophet, and God is telling you to speak and to preach and the words to say, and you're writing them down. You don't have to prove that God exists, because He's actually using you and He's speaking to you. So they never thought, I have to prove that this is coming from a being, if you know what I mean. So does this make sense? Is this understandable? So, because God was using and using them, and they already had a relationship with Him, they never thought, "Oh, I'm gonna have to prove that He exists," because they already had that relationship with Him. In like manner, the apostles and disciples who penned our New Testament seem never to have found it necessary to prove God's existence, obviously because they had fellowshiped with God in the flesh. They walked with Jesus. They knew He was God in the flesh. So they didn't have to try to prove that Jesus, that God existed, because they were with Him. Is this making sense? I don't want to get too far over your guys' heads, but so because they were with God, they never thought, we have to prove that God actually exists. So any doubts that the apostles had would have vanished forever when Jesus rose from the dead and empowered them for the work of the church and proved that He had power over life and death. That He was able to give them these gifts and that He had conquered death. But it wasn't long before skeptics began to arise, and they have continued through the centuries of the church era, abounding in number in our modern age, with knowledge has increased greatly. And with increased modern knowledge, it has become fashionable for many of the world's scholars, quote-unquote, to question the existence of God. And their skepticism has influenced many others. So it became a popular thing to try to prove that God exists. And so they look at everything around them to try to prove that God doesn't exist. Because that's the in thing to do, if you know what I mean. That's that's the intelligent, you know, that's the acceptable thing. Since I'm smart, then obviously there's got to be some way to prove that God doesn't exist. You know, again, it's all about their own accountability, what they want to believe in. Now, the tragedy in all of this is that God has made it simple to know the reality of himself. But this requires a little humility, as one might expect when dealing with his creator. And the scholars are too proud. You know, I don't know most scholars who would actually humble themselves, admit that they're wrong. Usually when they think that they believe that something is true, that they believe that something is right, and when you tell them otherwise, they never humble themselves. They don't accept it. And so, because they're too proud, they insist that any God and creator that there might be has to prove himself to them in their way. And they miss the most crucial matter pertaining to life and eternity and mislead many other lost souls away. Isn't that true today? You know, you see people that say, well, you know, God, prove yourself. You know, I'm waiting. You know, show me something that you exist. You know, most scholars today, they say that God has to prove himself. You know, they say, well, where's God? Show himself to me. You know, then I'll believe. But they always want him to prove himself in their way, in their terms, in their thinking. And if he doesn't, well, then God doesn't exist. That's a very proud way of looking at life, very proud way of thinking. But there's people all over this world that do the same thing. A lot of your atheists, a lot of your agnostics, they do that. They look and say, where is God? Where is this God that you talk about? And they expect God to prove himself. God doesn't have to prove himself to anybody. He already did when he rose up from the grave. That's all the proof that we need. But there's people that say, no, it can't, just can't be, because they refuse to believe. They refuse to have that faith. They refuse to humble themselves. So, let's see here. Hebrews 11:6 says, but without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Now, Clark Pennock, he writes this about this thought. He says, for the scriptures then, the existence of God is both a historical truth, because God acted into history, and an existential, which was based on existence, truth. God reveals himself to every soul. His existence is both objectively, by facts and logic, and subjectively, by feelings and morals, which are evident. It is necessary logically because our assumption of order, design, and rationality rests upon it. It is necessarily morally because there is no explanation for the shape of morality apart from it. It is necessary personally because the exhaustion of all material possibilities still cannot give satisfaction to the heart. The deepest proof for God's existence apart from history is just life itself. God has created man in his image, and man cannot elude or avoid the implications of this fact. Everywhere their identity pursues them. All right. Next one is the definition of God. The definition of God, there is but one only living and true God who is infinite. So your fill in there is one. So there is but, this is by the Westminster Catechism. So there is but one only living and true God, who is infinite in being and perfection, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions, immutable, immense, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, most wise, most holy, most free, most absolute, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutability and most righteous will for his own glory. He is most loving, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, the rewarder of them that diligently seek him, and withal most just and terrible in his judgments, hating all sin, and who will by no means clear or pardon the guilty. So if you look at some of those words, as you just think here, as they're describing God, just think about those things for a second. You know? He's almighty. He's most holy. But I mean, he's most loving, gracious, merciful. He's long-suffering. I mean, just the descriptions that they're talking here about God is just, it is amazing. It really is. It's really cool.
Where was that definition from?
The Westminster Catechism.
That
was a council that they kind of put together, and they had to figure out what, you know, what are we going to decide what God is and who he is. And so that was their definition that they came up with. It's a good definition. It really is.
I mean, if you don't understand Dr. Bass.
All right, so let me see how we're doing. A second here. Okay.
We don't have to do the quiz, right? No.
I'll probably ask you. According to the, I'll probably say, you know, according to the definition of God, how many gods are there? You know, and so I would just maybe just have the very first bit there. There is but one only living and true God. So I would write, I would highlight that to remember that. So
I think that's like blank. That's like, we have to write in something, that's what we can remember.
Yeah, I would say the definition of God, you know, I would say name the first bit, the first portion of the definition of God, which is that first comma mark. There is but one only living and true God. All right, so we're going to go ahead and finish